his friend.
Most guys I know are arseholes. I have some great arsehole friends, but that's not the point. Friendship's got nothing to do with that. It's, can you hang? Can you talk about this without any feeling of distance between you? Friendship is a diminishing of distance between people. That's what friendship is. And to me, it's one of the most important things in the world. Mick doesn't like to trust anybody. I'll trust you until you prove you're not trustworthy. And maybe that's the major difference between us. I can't really think of any other way to put it. I think it's something to do with just being Mick Jagger and the way he's had to deal with being Mick Jagger. He can't stop being Mick Jagger all the time. Maybe it's his mother in him. Bobby Keys was installed in an apartment not far from Nelcott, where one day he caused a disturbance by throwing his furniture out the window in a moment of Texan self-expression. But he was soon tamed into French customs by the beautiful Natalie Delon. She was staying with Bianca up the road after the wedding. It all seemed very recent to Bobby when I asked him to recall what happened when they got to know each other. I don't know why she was still there. Maybe she was dodging bullets. Mick had a house north of Nice where he and Bianca stayed, and I would ride out on my newly purchased motorcycle to see Natalie. Mick and I went down to get motorcycles at the same time. He got the 500 or 450 or whatever the hell it was. And then I saw the 750, which had seven cylinders, four fucking tailpipes. Give me that four-pipe one, man. I need four tailpipes because I got a French movie star I want to sit back here. We would melt the Côte d'Azur, screaming up and down the Moyenne Corniche between Nice and Monaco on that motorcycle, with Natalie and just a little bit of nothing, like a couple of Kleenex. Me with a yard of heart and a keg full of gas. I mean, rock and roll, good God almighty, can it get any better? We'd just take off and drive into the interior, the little French villages, a bottle of wine, a sandwich, while Natalie taught me some French. Those are the things that stay with you your whole life, going on those back country roads in France. It was just such a wonderful match. She was very funny in a quiet sort of way. And also, we used to smack each other in the butt with a syringe, just a little touch. It was like being in an adult Disneyland. She was a beauty. She stole my heart. I still love her. How can you not? It should be added that Bobby was married at the time, though not for long, to one of his many wives. And this wife was staying at their apartment while Bobby was out romancing Natalie. Bobby must have broken some marital record by staying out four nights in a row while everybody's telling his wife where he was. But the romance came to an abrupt end some months later when Natalie told Bobby it was over and told him never to call or try and get in touch. Bobby's heart was broken. He'd never had such a rejection, with no explanation from someone he'd been so close to. He carried the mystery around for decades, until recently, a journalist who had been close to the case explained to Bobby that it would have been too dangerous for Natalie and Bobby to have walked out publicly. Her son, Anthony, was protected by bodyguards. Natalie, too, had police protection. Nobody was sure who had killed the bodyguard Natalie had slept with. She had since been systematically harassed by his Yugoslav buddies. Bobby remembered that she had mentioned something about the danger, but he hadn't listened. If Natalie had had affection for Bobby, she wouldn't have prolonged their romance, was the explanation Bobby got. When Bobby heard this, he considered it a revelation. He was staying in my house, and when he came down to breakfast the next day, he was feeling good. All grateful now to Natalie for saving his life, and glad she hadn't told him the real circumstances at the time. Otherwise, he would have taken the unwise position of, "Who are these goddamn frog motherfuckers? I'm from Texas, I'll fucking eat 'em for dinner," as he put it, which wouldn't have worked. Bobby lived to blow his heart out on many more brown sugars, though he continued to live dangerously, as will be seen. How was all that music produced? 2 songs a day, written on a heroin habit, on what appeared to be a high energy? For all of its downsides, I'd never recommend it to anybody. Heroin does have its uses. Junk really is a great leveler in many ways. Once you're on that stuff, it doesn't matter what comes your way. You can handle it. There was the business of trying to get the whole Rolling Stones operation into this one house in the south of France. We had a record to cut, knew that if we failed, then the English would have won. And this house, this Bedouin encampment, contained anywhere from 20 to 30 people at a time, which never bothered me, because I have the gift of not being bothered, or because I was focusing, with assistance, on the music. It did bother Anita. It drove her up the wall. She was one of the few people who spoke French and German to the Austrian housekeeper. So she became the bouncer, getting rid of people sleeping under beds and overstaying their welcome. There were tensions, no doubt, and paranoia. I have heard her accounts of her nightmare spell as doorkeeper, and there were, of course, a lot of drugs. There were many people to feed, and one day, some holy men in orange robes came to visit and sat at the table with us, and within 2 seconds, diving for the food, they'd cleaned us out, eaten everything. In terms of staff relations, Anita was reduced to going into the kitchen and making throat-cutting gestures. She felt very threatened by the cowboys who surrounded us. Fat Jack lived round the corner in the cookhouse, which was separated from the main building. One day, we heard this enormous explosion, big, dull thud. We were all sitting around the great dining room, and suddenly, there at the entrance is Jacques, with his hair singed and soot over his face like a comic book illustration. He's blown up the kitchen, left the gas on too long before lighting it. He announces that there is no dinner. It has, literally, he says, gone through the roof. The smack helped my siege mentality. It was my wall against all of that daily stuff, because rather than deal with it, I shut it out to concentrate on what I wanted to do. You could go out and about totally insulated. Without it, in certain cases, you wouldn't have walked into that room at that time to deal with something. With it, you could go in there, brazen it off, and be very smooth, and then go back and get the guitar out and finish what it was you were doing. It made everything possible. Whereas straight, I don't know, there were too many things going on. While you're insulated like this, you live in a world where other people go round with the sun and the moon. They wake up, go to sleep. If you break that cycle, and you've been up for 4-5 days, your perception of these people who have just got up, who have crashed out, is very distant. You've been working, writing songs, transferring tape to tape, and these people come in and they've been to bed and everything. They've even eaten stuff. Meanwhile, you're sitting at this desk with a guitar and this pen and paper. Where the fuck you been? It got to the point where I'd be thinking, how can I help these poor people who have to sleep every day? For me, there's no such thing as time when I'm into recording. Time changes. I only realize that time's come into it when the people around me are dropping. Otherwise, I go on and on. 9 days was my record. Obviously, eventually, you hit the deck. But that perception of time, Einstein's pretty right. It's all relative. It's not only to the high quality of the drugs I had that I attribute my survival. I was very meticulous about how much I took. I'd never put more in to get a little higher. That's where most people fuck up on drugs. It's the greed involved that never really affected me. People think once they've got this high, if they take some more, they're going to get a little higher. There's no such thing, especially with cocaine. One line of good coke and you should be popped all night. But no, within 10 minutes, they're going to take another one, and then another one. That's crazy, because you're not going to get any higher. Maybe that's a measure of control, and maybe I'm rare in that respect. Maybe there I have an advantage. I was a taskmaster, especially in those days. I was a maniac for not letting up. If I've got the idea, and if it's right, it has to be put down now. I might lose it in 5 minutes. Sometimes I found it was better if I turned up and appeared pissed off without anybody knowing why. I'd get more out of them. It made them go, wow, he's weird. He's gone a bit eccentric or cantankerous. But at the end of the day, what I was looking for in a track or in a song came to fruition. It was a trick I only pulled if I thought it necessary. Also, it gave me 40 minutes in the John to shoot up while they considered what I'd said. I suppose the schedule was rather strange. It became known as Keith time, which in Bill Wyman's case made him a little cranky. Not that he said anything. At first we were going to start at 2 p.m., but that never happened. So he said we'd start at 6 p.m., which usually meant around 1 a.m. Charlie didn't seem to mind. Bill was particularly sensitive to it. I can understand that. I'd be famous. I'd go down to the John, and I'd be thinking about the song, and I'd take a shot, and 45 minutes later, I'm still sitting there trying to work out what I'm doing. I should have said, hey, take some time off. I'm thinking about this. That's what I didn't do. It was rude of me. Thoughtless. My saying, I'll just go and put Marlin to bed, was, it appears, the signal for my disappearance for several hours. A story is told by Andy Johns of Mick and Jimmy Miller and him, standing at the bottom of the stairs going, who's going to wake him up? I've had enough of this. I'm not fucking going up there. Why don't you do it, Andy? I'm just little Andy. Come on, you guys, I can't be dealing with this. All I can say is, it got worse in the later 70s on tour, when Marlin became the only one permitted to wake me up. But it worked. Somehow. Let Andy, the tireless engineer and the mighty mobile, give a testimonial. We were working on Rocks Off, and everyone else had left. Keith said, play that back for me, Andy. And it was 4 or 5 in the morning, and he went to sleep while the playback was on, and I thought, great, I can get out of here. So I went all the way back to this villa that Keith had been kind enough to rent for me and Jim Price. Just getting asleep, and ring, 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 ring. Where the fuck are you? I've got this great idea. It was a half-hour drive. Oh, sorry, Keith. I'll be right back. So I jumped in the car, went back, and he played this other Telecaster part, which is why the two-guitar interchange happens on Rocks Off, which is still stunning to me. And he just went right through it in one take. Bang. Done. and I'm so glad that it went that way. Then the circus left, and I was there in Nelcott with Anita and Marlon and a few skeleton crew into the late autumn, when the clouds roll in and it gets stormy and grey and the colours change, and then into the winter, which was pretty miserable, especially when you remember the summer. It also became menacing. The Brigade des Stupéfiants, as the drug squad was called, was on our back, gathering evidence, collecting statements from their usual suspects about the admittedly heavy activity at Nelcott, not just mine and the cowboys, but that of all the other consumers of stupefiants in the group. They had been snooping and spying, and it wasn't that difficult. In October, we were burgled, and my guitars, a great many of them, were stolen. We would have fled, but the French authorities wouldn't let us go. We were told we were officially under investigation on a number of heavy charges, and we'd have to go to a hearing in Nice in front of an investigating magistrate, when all the gossip and accusations from disgruntled or police-pressured informants at Nelcott would be aired. We were in some bad trouble. There was no habeas corpus in France to speak of. The state had total power. We could be locked up for months while the investigations took place, if the judge thought the evidence was strong enough, and maybe if he didn't. And this is where the, at that time, fledgling structure created by our manager, Prince Rupert Lowenstein, came into play. Later on, he would set up a global network of lawyers, of top-ranking legal gunslingers, to protect us. For now, he managed to acquire the services of a lawyer called Jean-Michel Pelissier. You couldn't have reached higher. He had been a lawyer for de Gaulle, and he had just been named as cabinet advisor to Prime Minister Jacques Chaban-Delmas, who was his bosom friend. Furthermore, our mouthpiece was also the legal advisor to the mayor of the Antibes region. And if that wasn't enough, the gifted Mr. Michel Pelissier was a friend of the prefect of the region, who was in charge of the police. Nice one, Rupert. The hearing took place in Nice, with Rupert interpreting for us. I remember after it was over, Rupert describing as terrifying the stuff that the police were leveling at us. But it was also very comic. It was, in fact, hilarious. A Peter Sellers French comedy, a movie in which a detective was solemnly and slowly typing while the judge got everything radically wrong. He was convinced that we were running a huge ring of prostitutes, that dope was being bought and sold by sinister people with German accents and this English guitarist. He wants to know whether you know a Mr. Alphonse Gurini or whatever. Never heard of him. Non, il ne le connaît pas. Whoever was grassing us up had had to dress up the information with ludicrous exaggerations and inventions to oblige the gendarmerie. So what came out was nothing but false information. Lowenstein had to point out that, no, this was a man trying to buy things, not sell them, and the crooks were trying to work out how they could charge him double or treble the rate. In the meantime, the wheels of Michel Pelissier were turning, so instead of the prospect of being in jail, even for a few years, a real possibility, Anita and I got one of several skin-of-teeth legal agreements that I've received in my time. It was decreed that we should leave French territory until I was allowed back. But I had to keep renting Nelcott as some kind of bond at $2,400 a week. It had reached the papers that the Stones were under investigation for dealing heroin, which began a whole long saga. The cat, as it were, was out of the bag. Aha! A heroin problem in the group, and in the music industry at large. It came with the standard slanders such as Anita peddling heroin to minors. Many witches' tales went into circulation about bad things going on at Nell Cot. The story wasn't over in France. We went to L.A., but in our absence, in the middle of December, the police raided Nell Cot and found what they were looking for, though it took them a full year to bring charges and a warrant for the arrest of Anita and me. When it came, they found us guilty of drug possession, fined us, and banned us from entering France for 2 years. All those peddling charges had been dropped, and finally I could stop paying the rent on Nell Cot, tearing up $1,000 bills. What we brought to L.A. from France was only the raw material for Exile, the real bare bones, no overdubs. On almost each song we'd said, we've got to put a chorus on here, we've got to put some chicks in there, we need extra percussion on that. We were already planning ahead without noting it down, so L.A. was basically to put the flesh on. For 4 or 5 months in L.A. in early 1972, we mixed and overdubbed Exile on Main Street. I remember sitting in the parking lot of Tower Records or Gold Star Studios, or driving up and down Sunset, listening at precisely the moment when our favorite DJ was teed up to play an unreleased track, so that we could judge the mix. How did it sound on radio? Was it a single? We did it with Tumbling Dice, All Down the Line, and many others. Called up a DJ at KRLA and sent him a dub. Fingers burning from the last cut, and we'd just take the car out and listen to it. Wolfman Jack or one of several other DJs in L.A. would put it on, and we'd have a guy standing over him to take it back again. Exile on Main Street had a slow start. It was the kiss of death to make double albums, according to the law of record companies and their anxieties about pricing and distribution and all that. The fact that we stuck to it, saying, look, that's what it is, that's what we've done here, and if it takes 2 albums, that's what we're going to do, was a bold move, and totally against all business advice. At first, it seemed that they'd been proven right. But then it just kept going and getting bigger and bigger, and it always had incredible reviews. And anyway, if you don't make bold moves, you don't get fucking anywhere. You've got to push the limits. We felt we'd been sent down to France to do something, and we'd done it, and they might as well have it all. When that finished, Anita and I lived in Stone Canyon, and I hooked back up with Graham for the last time I saw him. Stone Canyon was nice, but there was still the dope to get. There's a photograph of Graham on his Harley motorcycle, me on the back wearing Biggles glasses, and we're off to score. Hey, Graham, where are we going? Through the cracks of the city. He'd take me to places in L.A. I never knew existed. In fact, a lot of the dealers I remember going to were chicks, female junkies, FJs, as they were known in the trade. Once or twice it was a guy, but otherwise, Graham's connections were female. He thought they were cooler than guys as far as dealing dope and being available. Got the shit, but I ain't got a fix. Oh, I know a chick. He had a few bitches living up at the Riot House, the Continental Hyatt House on Sunset. Very popular with bands. Cheap. And you could park your bus. And there'd be some very pretty chick, total junkie, who'd lend you her needle. This was before the days of worrying about AIDS wasn't around then. This was when Graham met Emmylou Harris, saw her sing for the first time, though it was over a year before he recorded his great duets with her. Mind you, I'll bet it didn't start out as an idea to vocalize. He was a randy son of a bitch. Otherwise, the bad news was the dearth of any high-grade smack anywhere on the West Coast. We were reduced to Mexican shoe scrapings, MSS as we used to call it. This is really street shit. Brown came over from Mexico. It looked like shoe scrapings, and sometimes it was. And sometimes you'd have to do a test on it. You burn a little in a spoon first, just to see whether it liquefied or not, and smell it. There's a definite smell to it when you burn it. And you didn't mind if the smell you got was the smell of the cut, because old heroin, street heroin, was cut with lactose. But this stuff was thick. Sometimes you could hardly push it through the needle. It was a pretty low life. I never usually let it get to where I'd be left without clean shit. And street dope, that's where I drew the line. I decided to quit. This is not the stuff. This is not where it's at. All it's doing is keeping the motor going. One day, you wake up, and there's been a change of plans. You've got to go somewhere unexpected, and you realize that the first thing you think about is, okay, how do I handle the dope? The first thing on the list isn't your underwear, isn't your guitar, it's how do I hook up? Do I carry it with me and tempt fate? Or do I have phone numbers where I'm going, where I know that it's definitely there? Around now, with a tour coming up, was the first time it really hit me. I'd reached the end of the rope. I didn't want to be stuck in the middle of nowhere with no stuff. That was the biggest fear. I'd rather clean up before I went on the road. It's bad enough cleaning up by yourself, but the idea of putting the whole tour on the line because I couldn't make it was too much, even for me. My visa had run out for America, so I had to get out of there anyway. It was also time for Anita and me to leave L.A. She was pregnant with Angela. It was time to clean up, girl. I don't think Anita was particularly hooked. She didn't need it at the time, and obviously our robust Angela proves there was no serious health risk. Anita would have a hit now and again. It was me that was hooked big time. It was pretty dire. We lived on the edge. But I don't think Anita or I had any doubt that we could pull this off. It was just a matter of doing it. I can't remember any sense of fear or apprehension about quitting. It was just, this is what has to be done, and has to be done now. We couldn't do it in England or France because I couldn't go into either of those countries. So Switzerland became our destination. I loaded well up before we got on the plane, because I would go straight in a cold turkey by the time I arrived, with no provisions for supplies in Switzerland. In fact, it was pretty bad. There was confusion when we got there. I don't remember it, but I was taken in an ambulance from the hotel to the clinic. June Shelley, who had looked after all our affairs in Nilcott and was overseeing this episode as well, wrote in her memoir that she thought I was going to die in the ambulance. I looked like it anyway. I have no recollection of that. I was just being pushed around from pillar to post. Get me to the joint, let's cut it out and go through the shit. Dope me up so I can sleep through as much of 72 hours of hell as possible. I was being cleaned up by a Dr. Denver in a clinic in Vevey. He was American. He looked Swiss, close-shaven and rimless glasses. Himmler-esque. He spoke with a Midwestern twang. In actual fact, Dr. Denver's treatment was useless for me. Dodgy little bugger, too. I'd have rather cleaned up with Smitty, Bill Burrows' nurse, that hairy old matron. But Dr. Denver was the only one that spoke English. There was nothing I could do about it. You have a guy in cold turkey, you've got him where you want him. I can't imagine what other people think cold turkey is like. It is fucking awful. On the scale of things, it's better than having your leg blown off in the trenches. It's better than starving to death. But you don't want to go there. The whole body just sort of turns itself inside out and rejects itself for 3 days. You know in 3 days it's going to calm down. It's going to be the longest 3 days you've spent in your life. And you wonder why you're doing this to yourself when you could be living a perfectly normal, fucking rich rock star life. And there you are, puking and climbing walls. Why do you do that to yourself? I don't know. I still don't know. Your skin crawling, your guts churning. You can't stop your limbs from jerking and moving about. And you're throwing up and shitting at the same time. And shit's coming out your nose and your eyes. And the first time that happens for real, that's when a reasonable man says, I'm hooked. But even that doesn't stop a reasonable man from going back on it. While I was in the clinic, Anita was down the road having our daughter, Angela. Once I came out of the usual trauma, I had a guitar with me, and I wrote Angie in an afternoon, sitting in bed, because I could finally move my fingers and put them in the right place again. And I didn't feel like I had to shit the bed or climb the walls or feel manic anymore. I just went, Angie, Angie. It was not about any particular person. It was a name, like, oh, Diana. I didn't know Angela was going to be called Angela when I wrote Angie. In those days, you didn't know what sex the thing was going to be until it popped out. In fact, Anita named her Dandelion. She was only given the added name Angela because she was born in a Catholic hospital where they insisted that a proper name be added. As soon as Angela grew up a little bit, she said, never again do you call me Dandy. Chapter 9. We embark on the great tour of 1972. Dr. Bill opens his medicine bag and Hugh Hefner has us to stay. I meet Freddie Sessler. We move to Switzerland, then to Jamaica. Bobby Keys and I get in trouble on the road and are saved by Hawaii's Pineapple King. I buy a house in Jamaica. Anita is jailed there and expelled. Graham Parsons dies, and I am put on the most likely to list. Ronnie Wood joins the band. The Stones' big, ugly 1972 tour started on June 3rd. You can see how a sensitive person like Keith might need medication, but none of this stuff cheered me up. I hoped for better things. The idealism of the 1969 tour had ended in disaster. The cynicism of the 1972 tour included Truman Capote, Terry Southern, would have included William S. Burroughs if the Saturday Review had come up with Bill's price, Princess Lee Radziwill and Robert Frank. Featured sideshows on the tour involved a traveling physician, hordes of dealers and groupies, big sex and dope scenes. I could describe for you in intimate detail the public desecrations and orgies I witnessed and participated in on this tour. But once you've seen sufficient fettuccine on flocked velvet, hot urine pooling on deep carpets, and tidal waves of spewing sex organs, they seem to run together, so to speak. Seen one, you've seen them all. The variations are trivial. Stanley Booth. Keith, standing in the shadows. I have never been on anything like this. I have been on trips with extraordinary people before, but they are always directed outward. This totally excludes the outside world. To never get out, to never know what city you're in? I cannot get used to it. Robert Frank, photographer and director. Cocksucker Blues. The 72 tour was known by other names. The Cocaine and Tequila Sunrise Tour, or the STP, Stones Touring Party. It was mythologized along the lines of Stanley Booth's list of excesses above. Personally, I never saw anything like this. Stanley must have been exaggerating, or he was a very innocent boy. It was the case, nevertheless, that by this time we couldn't get a reservation in any hotel above a Holiday Inn. It was the beginning of the booking of whole hotel floors, with no one else allowed up, so that some of us, like me, could get privacy and security. It was the only way we could have a degree of certainty that when we decided to party, we could control the situation, or at least get some warning if there was trouble. The whole entourage had exploded in terms of numbers of roadies and technicians and of hangers-on and groupies. For the first time, we travelled in our own hired plane with a lapping tongue painted on. We had become a pirate nation, moving on a huge scale under our own flag with lawyers, clowns, attendants. For the guys running the operation, there was maybe one battered typewriter and hotel or street phones to run a North American tour through 30 cities. A feat of organization on the part of our new tour manager, Peter Rudge, a 4-star general among the anarchists. We never missed a show, though we came near it. The guy that opened for us in almost every city was Stevie Wonder, and he was barely 22. I remember stories about Stevie when we were on tours in Europe with his great band. They'd say, "The motherfucker can see." We walk into a brand new hotel, he picks up his keys, heads straight for the elevator. I found out later that he'd memorized the plan of a Four Seasons hotel. 5 steps up here, 2 steps to the elevator. It was no big deal to him. He only did it to fuck them up. The band was rocking on that tour. Better to hear an impression from another resident writer, Robert Greenfield. There were so many writers on that tour, it had become like a political campaign in terms of coverage. Our old friend Stanley Booth retired, disgusted by the new mob of socialites and famous authors who had diluted the once pure patch, the ballrooms and smelly bordellos, and dressing rooms filled with parasites. But we played on. In Norfolk and Charlotte and Knoxville, the set seems to fly from beginning to end, the musicians completely locked into one another and on time, like a championship team in its finest, most fluid moments. But only people who listen, like Ian Stewart, and the Stones themselves and their supporting musicians, are aware of the magic that's going down. Everyone else is either worrying about logistics or trying to find a way to get off. The travelling physician mentioned by Stanley will call Dr. Bill to give it a Burrowsian ring. His speciality was billed as emergency medicine. Mick, who was getting appropriately nervous about people trying to get at him, there were threats, there were freaks fixated on him. People would walk up and hit him. The angels wanted him dead, wanted a doctor around who could keep him alive if he got shot on stage. Dr. Bill was there, however, primarily for the pussy. And being quite a young, good-looking doctor, he got plenty. He printed these cards. Dr. Bill, as it were, physician of the Rolling Stones. He would scout the audience before we went on and give out 20 or 30 of those cards to the most foxy, beautiful girls, even if they were with a guy. He wrote on the back the name of our hotel and the suite number to call. And even girls with guys would go home and come back. They'd give this to the guard, and Dr. Bill knew that out of the 6 or 7 girls who would come, there were 1 or 2 who he could get by saying he would introduce them to us. He was into getting laid every night. And he also had this case of every kind of substance, Demerol, anything you wanted. He could write scripts in every city. We used to send chicks to his room and take his medicine bag. There would be a line waiting in the room with a waste bag of syringes while he was giving out the Demerol. In Chicago, there was an acute shortage of hotel rooms to add to our problem of unpopularity with booking clerks. There was a hardware convention, a McDonald's convention, a furniture convention. The lobbies were full of name badges. So Hugh Hefner thought it would be a laugh to invite some of us to stay in the Playboy Mansion. I think he regretted it. Hugh Hefner, what a nut. We've worked the lowest pimps to the highest. The highest being Hefner, a pimp nonetheless. He threw the place open for the Stones, and we were there for over a week, and it's all plunges in the sauna and the bunnies, and basically it's a whorehouse, which I really don't like. The memory, however, is very, very hazy. I know we did have some fun there. I know we ripped it up. Hefner had been shot at just before our visit, and the place resembled the state house of some Caribbean dictatorship with heavily armed security everywhere. But Bobby and I avoided that, and the tourists who had come to watch us playing in the Playboy Mansion, and retreated into our own entertainment. We had the doc there, and we gained one of the bunnies for him. The deal was, we get free dibs on your bag, and you can have Debbie. I felt the script had been written. Play it to the hilt. Bobby and I played it a little far when we set fire to the bathroom. Well, we didn't. The dope did. Not our fault. Bobby and I were just sitting in the john. Comfortable, nice john. Sitting on the floor, and we've got the doc's bag, and we're just smorgasbording. I wonder what these do. Bong! And at a certain point, talk about hazy or foggy, Bobby says, it's smoky in here. And I'm looking at Bobby and can't see him. And the drapes are smouldering away. Everything was just about to go off big time, to the point where I can't see him. He's disappeared in this fog. Yes, I guess it is a bit smoky in here. It was a really delayed reaction. And then suddenly, a flurry at the door, and the fire alarms start going, beep, beep, beep. What's that noise, Bob? I don't know. Should we open the window? Someone shouts through the door, are you all right? Oh, yeah, we're fucking great, man. So he just turns away, and we don't know exactly what to do. Maybe if we're quiet and walk out and we pay for the reconstruction? And then a little later, there was a thumping on the door. Waiters and guys in black suits bringing buckets of water. They get the door open, and we're sitting on the floor, our pupils very pinned. I said, "We could have done that ourselves. How dare you bust in on our private affair?" Hugh decamped soon after that and moved to L.A. Hefner recorded in his little black book from a memo dated 6/28/72. For your information, the following is a list of damage that resulted from the visit of the Rolling Stones. The white rug in the red and blue room bathroom was burnt and needed to be replaced. The toilet seat was also burnt and had to be replaced. Two bath mats and four towels were also burnt. Red room chair and couch are stained, possibly to the point of needing reupholstering. Red room bedspread is badly stained. We are hoping it will come out in cleaning. Some of my most outrageous nights, I can only believe, actually happened because of corroborating evidence. No wonder I'm famous for partying. The ultimate party, if it's any good, you can't remember it. You get these brief vignettes of what you did. Oh, you don't remember shooting a gun? Pull up the carpet, look at those holes, man. I feel a bit of shame and embarrassment. You can't remember that? When you got your dick out, swinging from the chandelier, anybody up for grabs, wrap it in a £5 note? Nope, don't remember a thing about it. It's very hard to explain all that excessive partying. You didn't say, "Okay, we're going to have a party tonight." It just happened. It was a search for oblivion, I suppose, though not intentionally. Being in a band, you're cooped up a lot, and the more famous you get, the more of a prison you find yourself in. The convolutions you go through just to not be you for a few hours. I can improvise when I'm unconscious. This is one of my amazing tricks, apparently. I try and stay in contact with the Keith Richards I know, but I do know there's another one that lurks occasionally about. Some of the best stories about me relate to when I'm not actually there, or at least not consciously so. I'm obviously operating because I've had it corroborated by too many people, but I can reach a point, especially on cocaine after a few days, where I just crack, where I think I'm totally crashed out and asleep, but in actual fact, I'm doing things that are quite outrageous. This is called pushing the envelope, but nobody showed me how big the envelope is. There is a certain point where suddenly everything cuts off because you've been pushing it too far. But it's just too much fun, and you're writing songs, and then there's some bitches, and you go to that rock and roll thing, and loads of friends are coming by and refueling you, and there is a point where the switch does go off, and you still keep moving. It's like another generator kicks in, but the memory and the mind have totally gone. My friend Freddie Sessler would have been a mine of information about this. God rest his soul. Chandeliers do produce one memory, which might be classed as a close shave. I wrote it in a notebook under the heading "A Celestial Shotgun." A lady, nameless, whom I was entertaining, was so grateful she insisted on entertaining me. She stripped naked and leaped up and grasped the huge chandelier, then proceeded to perform some very athletic convolutions as the light beams dazzled around the room. It was very entertaining. Then, with the nimbleness of an acrobat, she let go and landed on the couch beside me, At that moment, the chandelier detached itself from its moorings and shattered on the floor. We both huddled together under a blast of crystal, laughing hysterically as it rained down on us. Then it got even more entertaining. We had some sport with Truman Capote, author of In Cold Blood. One of the group of mixed society friends who had attached themselves to the tour and who included Princess Lee Radziwill, Princess Radish to us, as Truman was just Truby. He was on assignment from some high-paying magazine, so he was ostensibly working. Truby said something bitchy and whiny backstage. He was being an old fart, actually complaining about the noise. It was just some snide, queenie remark, and sometimes I don't give a damn. Other times, it just gets up my nose. This happened after a show, and I was already on cloud nine. Motherfucker needed a lesson. I mean, this snooty New York attitude, you're in Dallas. It got a little raucous. I remember back at the hotel kicking Truman's door. I'd splattered it with ketchup I'd picked up off a trolley. Come out, you old queen. What you doing round here? You want cold blood? You're on the road now, Truby. Come and say it out here in the corridor. Taken out of context, it sounds like I'm some right sort of Johnny Rotten. But I must have been provoked. What was hilarious was how Truman, for some unknown reason, took a shine to Bobby. Truman was on the Johnny Carson show at the end of his little stint with the Stones, and Johnny asked him, "What do you think about all this rock and roll hoopla and bizarre stuff you've been doing?" "Oh, yes. I've been on the road with the Rolling Stones." "And Bobby is watching this on TV, of course." Johnny said, "Well, tell us some of your experiences. Who did you meet?" "Oh, I met this delightful young man from Texas." And Bobby's going, "No, don't do it." And Bobby's phone started ringing immediately from the Texas League of Gentlemen. "Ah, you and Truman, huh?" I remember the gig in Boston on July 19th, 1972, for two reasons. The first was the motorcade the Boston police provided to get us to the stadium when their buddies in Rhode Island had wanted to lock us up. We'd landed in Providence from Canada, and while they were searching all the baggage, I was sleeping on the fender of a fire truck, one of those nice, curved, old-fashioned ones with the mudguards. I felt a sudden explosion of heat, a flashbulb right in my face, and I just leaped up and grabbed the camera, fuck off, kicked the photographer, and I got arrested. And Mick and Bobby Keys and Marshall Chess demanded to be arrested with me. I've got to give that to Mick. But in Boston that day, the Puerto Ricans got pissed off in their section of town, and they were kicking up shit. And the mayor of Boston was saying, "You let those fuckers go right now, because I've got to deal with this riot, and don't give me a Rolling Stones riot on the same day." And so we were sprung, and these cops escorted us to Boston post-haste, with outriders and civic fanfare. The other big event that day was the knock on my hotel room door that led to my facing Freddie Sessler for the first time. I don't know how he got there, but back then, everybody would come to my room. It doesn't happen anymore. I couldn't stand the pace. But in this case, I wasn't busy at the moment, and he looked intriguing. Jewish to the max, dressed in ridiculous clothes. What a character. "I've got something you'll like," he said. And he pulled out this full ounce with a still unbroken seal of pure Merc cocaine. The real deal. "This is a gift. I love your music. This is the stuff that when you open it, it almost flies out of the bottle. Swoosh." and I liked my cocaine off and on up until then. But apart from the cocaine you got from junkies in England, it was street shit. You never knew if it was amphetamine. And from now, once a month, Freddie would deliver a full ounce of pure cocaine. No money changed hands. Freddie never wanted to be labelled as a supplier. He wasn't a dealer you could call up and ask, "Hey, Fred, you got any..." It was beyond that. Freddie and I just hit it off. He was an incredible character. He was 20 years older than me. His history, even by the average experience of any Jew who lived through the Nazi invasion of Poland, was a story of horror and almost miraculous survival. Only 3 of the 54 of his relatives in Poland survived. A story not unlike that of the young Roman Polanski, having to fend for himself and evade the Nazis, who had taken the rest of his relations to the camps. I didn't find out the details of this for a while, but in the meantime, Freddie quickly became a fixture on tour. He took on the role of my second dad for 10 or 15 years after that, probably without realizing it. I recognized something in Freddie almost immediately. He was a pirate and an adventurer and an outsider, though at the same time, one with extraordinarily good contacts. He was incredibly funny, sharp as a razor, with all the experience behind it. He'd made a fortune about 5 times over, blown it each time and made it again. The first one out of pencils. He said, "What gets shorter every time you use it?" He made a fortune out of office supplies. And then he got another idea, flying round New York in a holding pattern for an hour, looking at all the buildings and the lights. Whoever supplies those light bulbs is making a fucking fortune. 2 weeks later, it's him. Very simple ideas. Some others were not so simple or successful. Snake venom for curing multiple sclerosis. He put a lot of money into the doomed Amphicar, that amphibious vehicle that was described in one review as the car that may revolutionize drowning. It never quite made it. Dan Aykroyd has one, but who apart from him needs a car that can cross rivers when you've got bridges? Freddie was like a Leonardo of sorts, but running these businesses? Forget about it. The minute it worked, he was bored to death, and he'd blow it. Of course, Mick didn't take to Freddie, nor did a lot of other people. He was too loose a cannon. Graham probably drove a bigger wedge between Mick and me than Freddie did, because that was music. But Mick despised Freddie. He only put up with them because to annoy Freddie would be to annoy me. I think Freddie and Mick did have a couple of good times together, but they were rare. Freddie would do things for Mick and not even let me know, put him in touch with this whore or this bitch. He would grease Mick's path. Mick would get in touch with Freddie when he wanted something, and Freddie would oblige. People would knock Freddie, say he was crude, insulting, vulgar, and why not? You could think anything you wanted of him, but Freddie was one of the best men I ever met. Totally horrible, revolting, absolutely over the top, stupid at times, but solid. I can't think of another bloke that was solid all the way. I was stupid in those days and over the top too. I dare Freddie to be more outrageous than he really wanted to be, which was my fault. But I knew there was a thing in the man. He didn't care. He didn't give a shit. He thought he died at 15. I'm dead anyway, even if I'm still alive. Everything else from here on is gravy, even if it's shit. Let's make the shit into gravy if we can. And that's the way I took Freddie's basic fuck it attitude. 15 was when he watched his grandfather, the most revered figure in his life, and his uncle, being tortured and then shot by two Nazi officers in broad daylight in the main square of their town, while he held on to his terrified grandmother. His grandfather was selected for this horrifying punishment because he was the leader of the Jewish community in the area. Then Freddy too was picked up, and that was the last he saw of any member of his family then living in Poland. All were taken off to the camps. Freddy left an autobiographical manuscript dedicated to me, which is embarrassing because the other dedicatee is Jacob Goldstein, the grandfather whom he watched being murdered. The horrors are described, but it's also a fascinating story of survival, very Pasternak in subject matter, and it explains what made this man I came to be so close to. He tells first, for example, of a well-off middle-class Jewish family in Krakow in 1939, going to their summer home outside the town with its stables and barns, smokehouses and mowed lawns, and a gypsy woman comes across the poppy fields and says, "I'll read your fortune, cross my palm with silver," and all of that. And she predicts doom for the entire family, except specifically three members, two of them absent from Poland, the third being Freddy, who she says will go east to Siberia. The Germans came in September 1939. Freddy was sent to a labor camp in Poland, a hastily organized prison from which he escaped. He spent several weeks running at night and hiding in the frozen forest, stealing from farmhouses, heading eastward to the Russian-occupied sector of Poland. He crossed a frozen river at night with bullets landing around him and ran straight into the arms of the Red Army. These were the days of the Hitler-Stalin Pact, but anything was better than Germans. Freddy was sent to a Siberian gulag, as the fortune teller had predicted. Freddy was 16. The plot of unremitting punishment and desperation is something like Candide, as are the descriptions of the Siberian conditions that Freddy managed to survive. In later life, Freddy would wake up screaming with nightmares about it. He and the few of his Polish fellow prisoners who were still alive were released when Germany invaded Russia. With thousands of released prisoners from other camps, Freddy started out to reach the railhead, a distance of 100 miles or so. Only 300 made it. Freddy joined the Polish army in Tashkent, contracted typhoid, got discharged, and joined the Polish navy in 1942. His job was watching radar for long hours. The ship's doctor introduced him to pharmaceutical cocaine. After that, things began to get a little better. Fred's brother Sigi, the only other surviving member of his family of seven children, was in Paris at the Sorbonne when the Germans invaded Poland. He joined the Polish army and later managed to get to England. Freddy joined him in London after the war. Sigi became a famous club owner and restaurateur, co-owner of Les Ambassadeurs, which quickly became a hangout for four-star generals and Hollywood stars who came to entertain U.S. troops. When he opened Sigi's club in Charles Street, Mayfair in 1950, he'd become personal friends with the likes of Frank Sinatra, Ronald Reagan, and Bing Crosby. It became the hangout of Princess Margaret, the Aga Khan, and the like. So Sigi, and by proxy Freddy, who knew Sinatra and Marilyn Monroe, were very well connected. It served Freddy well on at least two occasions I know of. Once, when he was coming through a New York airport, and was arrested for some gear in his briefcase, and they were going to put him away, and somehow they didn't. The whole incident disappeared. And much later, in 1999, on the No Security Tour, he was arrested for possession in Las Vegas, taken to the cells, the whole caboodle. Freddie made one call. This was witnessed by Jim Callahan, my muscle at the time. And 3 hours later, he had a letter of apology from the mayor's office. And the gear and the money were handed back. When I met Freddie, he had his hair extension center in New York, inspired by his own woven hair attachments. Cocaine and Quaaludes were his favorite drugs, and he had access to the very best of them. A scheme in Miami to